Rabbi Liebtag. We're looking forward to Hanukkah. We're live from Israel, where it already is Hanukkah. Bakasha, part one of two.
Truth is, the Hanukkah should be, we'll see later on today, maybe, or next week, that in Chutz Laaretz is more Hanukkah than here, because the 24th of Kislev is really the first day of Hanukkah, as we'll see. But we'll see that later today. Okay, let's get started. I'll share my screen. Make sure it's still here. Here we go. Okay, so today is class number 8 in Shemitah and the beginning of 7. We're going to take from 7 to 8. And our topic is Hanukkah, whether it's a national, religious, universal holiday. And just quickly, last week I was away from home, so I didn't have my setup. So I'm not sure how clear everything was. But we spent a lot of time looking like at a full Tanakh. And the whole unit of the Mishkan in Sefer Shemot and the 7 days of Miluim. But the main thing I want to show you, how the 7 days of Miluim end the commandment to build the Mishkan. And then after the 7 days of Miluim, on the 8th day, Yom HaShmini, the Mishkan becomes functional and the Shekhinah returns. So that's the beginning of the idea of 7 to 8. We have a similar concept by Brit Milah we talked about before. And so in light of that, we're going to discuss Hanukkah and why it's celebrated for 8 days and why we call it Hanukkah. So before we do anything, I want to stop my screen share and we'll give a little participation. I want someone to tell me, why would you consider Hanukkah a national holiday? What makes Hanukkah a national holiday? Yes, you can chat it or you can participate and say.
So we beat the
military victory.
Yeah. It's simple, right? Yeah. Like all the holidays, remember the classic line? They tried to kill us, we won, let's eat. So it fits the overall category. It's a national holiday because we were under Greek rule. We were under Greek oppression. And we went to war against them. And we won the war. And if you remember the Rambam in Hilchot Hanukkah, that's the opening Rambam, the famous one I'm sure you've all seen before. The Rambam says, what's the big deal about Hanukkah? We return to Ribbonut, we return to sovereignty for the first time in the Second Temple period. So it's a celebration of our return to sovereignty. Malchut Yisrael returned for over 200 years. Now, during the Malchut, the good kings were barely, you know, maybe 20, 30 years of good kings. But still, it's considered we're sovereign and that's what to celebrate. And therefore, there's no doubt it's a national holiday. The problem with the national holiday is there were a lot of national holidays in the Second Temple period, like very similar to nowadays, like Yom HaTzmaut and Yom Yerushalayim. And we'll see later on, there's a Megillah called Megillat Tanit that talks about all these national holidays. And on those national holidays, what was special about them, you weren't allowed to do eulogies and you weren't allowed to fast. And there were special days. And all those days, every month had 1 or 2 days like that. There's the Megillah, there's a whole scroll that has them written up called Megillat Tanit from the time of the early Tanaim. And most of them start from the time of the Hashmonaim. And later, they're all big events. And all those dates are nullified when the temple is destroyed. So the question we have to deal with later on, I understand why Hanukkah is a national holiday during the Second Temple period after the victory. Why does it remain a national holiday after we lost our sovereignty? So that's question number one. Now, why would you call it a religious holiday? And what's religious about it? Yeah, Debbie?
We have mitzvot and we say challah.
Okay, well, challah we could say, are we saying challah because of our national victory? Or are we saying challah because of the miracle of the menorah? You ever wonder?
Right. It's a rededication of the mikdash. That's the religious part.
Yeah, the religious part is the menorah, the religious, the temple, the whole idea we returned to temple service. We rededicated the temple and all that stuff with the miracle of the menorah. So for sure, what's the proof it's a religious holiday? Because the tati, you know, it's kept by secular Jews in Israel and by religious Jews in Chutz Laaretz, isn't it? But the meaning of lighting candles is so deep and so religious. It's a classic religious holiday. Now, why would you call it a universal holiday? But put it this way, I think you agree with me that most people don't see it as a universal holiday. Agreed? The first two parts of the title was easy.
When you say universal, do you mean the whole world?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
At least our planet, okay? I'll leave it to our planet. I'm not saying the whole cosmos, but at least our planet.
Because it comes in the winter solstice.
Exactly. Okay. We're going to see, and that will be, we'll develop that today. we'll see there's a, what's called, it's a winter solstice holiday, which doesn't make any sense for two reasons. One, because no one usually thinks about that when they celebrate Hanukkah. Because what happened? The battle ended on the 24th to 25th of Kislev. The battle's over, we won. Had the battle ended 2 months earlier, 2 months later, and it's not, and there's no winter solstice on a Jewish calendar. Agreed? We have a lunar calendar, so there is no December 21st. So that's why usually it's not understood as a universal holiday unless you've heard part of this year before or similar. Now, the other thing we're all familiar with is that there's another non-Jewish holiday, a very Christian holiday that comes out the same time of year called Christmas, which you're familiar with. And that you would think that that's totally by chance that they come out the same time of year, other than the shopping and the presents. But knows we're sharing themes with them. Is that good or bad? You can argue. But ask the average person, there should be no connection between his birth. That seems to be by chance. Of course, nothing God does is by chance. That's supposed to be a joke. But the fact he was born then, and the fact that we won the battle at the same time of year, give or take a couple weeks, seems to be totally by chance. If we get an abstention, we'll see that's not by chance. And we have to try and show today what makes it a universal holiday. And understanding why it's a universal holiday will help us explain why it's a national holiday and why it becomes a religious holiday. Hope that's clear. It's probably not, because you couldn't understand that. But by the time this year's over, I want to explain why, first and foremost, it's a universal holiday. But that's how it starts. Because of its universal nature, that made it a national holiday. And because it was a national holiday, later it became a religious holiday. We'll try to make sense out of that by the time we finish. Okay, now we'll get to work. Okay. First thing I want to do is talk about the name Hanukkah. Now, from what you remember, why is Hanukkah called Hanukkah? What's Hanukkah mean in Hebrew?
Dedication.
Dedication.
Okay. Now give me the wrong reason, the right wrong reason that everyone says.
Chanukah
Fei. That's cute. That they run the battle on the 25th, but that's by chance again, almost like the two holidays coming out by chance. But even if the battle didn't happen and end on that time, as we'll see, it happened earlier. Chanukah doesn't mean Chanukah Fei. Chanukah means dedication. Now, what's the next word? Chanukah of what?
Mizbeach.
Of the altar, of the menorah, of the Mishkan, of the Mikdash.
Mizbeach.
So that's what we have to see. What's being dedicated? What's being rededicated? We'll see. And why the name happens to be Hanukkah? That we have to see. So now, anyone know where we have the word Hanukkah the first time in this context in Chumash?
Mishkan, setting up the Mishkan.
In what book?
Zot Chanukat HaMizbeach.
We're going to read that. In fact, we're going to read that tomorrow morning.
Shlomo.
So what I want to begin with, because tomorrow is the first day of Hanukkah, and we're going to read the Torah reading. And there's a big machloket where to start the Torah reading from. I can start from the beginning of Perek Zayin, the beginning of chapter 7, or I can start from the end of chapter 6, which is Birkat Kohanim. Check your local shul what the minute is. Edom Mizrach usually start with Birkat Kohanim, and Ashkenazim don't understand Chumash as well as the Svaradim, and they start, I think I have it right. So what I want to do is I want to show you why I think we should start with Birkat Kohanim, but first we have to understand why it's called Chanukah, and the idea of Chanukah HaMizbeach, because this is going to be the main source. So we're going to share my screen, and we're going to... here are the sources and here are the screen share. Here we go. First thing I want to show you is Perek Vav in Sefer Bamidbar. Sefer Bamidbar, basically, the narrative of Sefer Bamidbar is Am Yisrael getting ready to leave Har Sinai and begin, we put the Mishkan together. We're getting ready to leave Har Sinai and begin our march to the land of Israel. And the first 10 chapters, the narrative sections, pretty much are preparation for the march. That's why the first four chapters is a Mifkad. We check our army, we count our soldiers and get the soldiers ready. We bring Pesach Rishon, Pesach Sheni. We get a tour guide. We have Chatzotzrot. There's a lot of things we do to prepare. And we'll see how it'll help us understand Hanukkah very soon. But in the middle of all those chapters of preparation, we have some laws. For some reason in Perek Vav, we have the laws of Nazir. Okay? Now, then as there's a person who takes himself away from wine and from and doesn't cut his hair, but it's mainly like growing his hair for a while. But if he becomes tamei in the middle, he has to do what? He has to start over again. But when it's over, what does he need to do? This is the Torah of the Nazir when he finishes. Remember that word? Malot. What does he do? He brings a korban. What's a korban? First, it's a keves for an ola, and a kifsa for a chatat, and a shlamim. Three korbanot. A ola, chatat, and shlamim. Okay? And then some bread, a salve matzot, full of oil, and he brings them to the Kohen. And then what happens? What's the Kohen do? The Kohen takes the part of the animal and takes some of the the matzah, everything he does, and he puts it on the hands of the Nazir, and he waves it in front. And there's a whole, there's a whole sort of ceremony. And how many days does this happen for? This is on the last day. Here, I'm sorry. But in the middle, I'm sorry, beforehand. If he becomes tamei in the middle, the Bet HaBitom, and he becomes tamei, he has to shave everything. Right? And he's tamei for 7 days. And the Yom HaShmini, he brings two Torim. I'm just bringing this. There's a lot of similarities between the laws of Nazir and the 7 days of Miluim. It's not the same thing, but when you, it's too complicated for today, and I don't want to go sidetrack there. Also, I want to show you is that in the laws of Nazir and Perek Vav, I have echoes of the 7 days of Miluim in Yom HaShmini, and I also have echoes of, again, the transition from 7 to 8, and a Korban, which is very similar to the 7 days of Miluim. Let me just explain why there's a similarity. In the 7 days of Miluim, which we're going to see soon, or we saw actually last week, what's happening? We're turning the regular people to Kohanim. We're taking our own sons and making them Kohanim. If you remember that opening line, V'zesher taselem, l'kadesh otam l'chayinli. Here's what you need to do to turn them from regular humans to regular people to Kohanim. And I'm basically changing their status. And to change their status, I need to do some procedure. Some korban, it's called a korban machshirin. The same thing when someone is not allowed to be in the temple, like a yoledet, who did nothing wrong. She had a baby, but because she needs time out from God for 40 days or 8 days, but when her time out is over and she's going to be able to return to the temple again and resume normal life, she needs to do something symbolic to change her status. And therefore, that change of status or the upgrade of status is going to be this, it's called a korban machshirim when you bring a chatat and olah. All I'm trying to show you is that Nazir has a lot of laws of a Kohen. That's obvious here. The laws of the laws of Nazir, the similarity to Kohen, especially to Kohen Gadol, that you can't become tamei to relatives. That's a classic. That's one of the main similarities. So in many ways, there's simply a small similarity between the 7 days of Miluim and the laws of Nazir. Then for some reason, we have Birkat Kohanim, which clearly belonged in Parshat Shmini, because the first time Aaron did Birkat Kohanim was in Yom HaShmini. For some reason, it's recorded here. And then in chapter 7, which we're going to see in a minute, we have what? We have the Yom Chalom Moshe Lakimet HaMisham. We have the Nesim, which we'll read about very soon in the word Chanukah, in chapter 7. And when chapter 7 is over and we finish the 12 days that the Nesim brought the Korbanot, in chapter 8, what do we have? We have Parsha Balotcha and the Mitzvah to light the menorah. Now, I want to ask someone a question. Why is... But this commandment in the beginning of Balotcha and Perachet, which we're going to read the last day of Hanukkah, where does it belong? Where should it be? Where should the mitzvah be when God tells Aaron how to light the menorah? Where should that be located?
What we did last week.
Exactly. It belongs in Parshat in Parshat Truma with the laws of the menorah, or at least in Tetzaveh when they have the exact same words to La'alot Ner Tamid. But it belongs in Truma Tetzav, it belongs in Shemot with the Mishkan. Or maybe somewhere in Vayikra. And maybe with Parshat Amor, we have it again in Parshat Amor, don't we? In Parshat Amor, in Perach Avdalet, after the Hagim, we have the Shtei Lechem. We have the Lechem Apanim and laying the menorah every day. We have it there. What's it doing here in Parshat Balotcha? Now, it seems like added for no reason. What's the classic answer everyone knows? Remember what Rashi says?
Aaron fell.
Yeah. Aaron was depressed. Okay? Right. Yeah. Aaron was depressed because in the scene they got the spotlight and he's the nobody there. No. I want to talk about chronology now. And you'll see something which I think is amazing. You have to pay attention. I know last week's show was complicated. Probably this week's show will be more, but I'll try to keep it simple. I want to follow the chronology in Chumash and begin with, where does this belong? So let's go now to my PDF file, which should be right here. Okay. The word Hanukkah, we're going to find in chapter 7. But I want to show you where chapter 7 is going to belong. Okay. So before we do chapter 7 in Bamidbar, we find the word Hanukkah with Hanukkah Tamizbeach explicitly. To understand where it belongs chronologically, I have to go to Sefer Shemot, the last chapter of Sefer Shemot, Perek Mem. Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Lemor, it's real easy Hebrew, so I'm just doing the Hebrew, because this is real easy Hebrew. V'yom achodesh harishon b'echad achodesh, takim et mishkan ha'moed. We started building the Mishkan right after Yom Kippur, when we got God's second Luchot, which we talked about last week. For 6 months, we built the Mishkan. Remember Chazal v'Midrash that we finished everything was ready by Hanukkah, and we waited for 3 months to dedicate it. We'll see later why they say that. But simple pshat is, God tells Moshe, when are you going to dedicate the Mishkan or assemble it? On the first day of the first month, a year after we got ready to leave Egypt in Parshat HaChodesh. And you put there the Aron, all the Kelim. I'll skip all the Kelim. Listen carefully. V'lekakta shemen ha-mishkan, on the day that you put it all together, you take the anointing oil, mashakta ha-mishkan, that ko asherbo v'kidashto v'ko kelav, v'ya kodesh. So on that day, what do? You do mashikha and you makadesh and later that's exactly what's going to happen. Now, just keep that in mind. Why? Because the first line we're going to read tomorrow, Bami prepared Zion, listen how it fits perfectly. Vayi biyom kalot Moshe lakim et ha-mishkan. Let's take a quick, let me just annotate real fast. Get my little drawing thing. There we go. Vayi biyom kalot Moshe lakim et ha-mishkan. Thank you. Got that? Vayim shachoto. By Kadesh Oto, the Kokelav. Okay. Beta Mizbeach. Okay. Baim Shachem again. By Kadesh Otam. We're good? That should be as easy as possible to see. In other words, chapter 7 in Sefer Bamidbar is linked to chapter 40 in Sefer Shemot. And chronologically, it's the exact same day. No doubt about it. What happens on that day? They agree when they see Roshei Beit Avotam, Hem Nisei Matot, Hem Omdim Apkudim. Remember what the first thing they bring is? The first thing they bring is wagons. We're going to stop the share for a minute. They bring wagons. And why are they bringing wagons? That's for the Levites. In addition to the wagons, they're going to bring also a Kiddush, a Flesha Kiddush. Now, if I follow Pshat, almost all the Parshim agree with this. Yom HaShmini, which we talked about last week, there's 7 days of preparation. Yom HaShmini is Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and what's the proof? Because in the end of chapter 40 in Sefer Shemot, the Shechina returns, and in Sefer Bayikra and Perek Tet in Parshat Shmini, we have the korbanot we have to bring because God's Shechina is returning. So simple pshat is Yom HaShmini is the same day as Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and what happens on that day? The Shechina returns in Sefer Shemot because everyone followed God's directions. Kasher Tzif Hashem et Moshe. The Shekhinah returns in Sefer Vayikra because the korbanot that we bring. Remember the Aaron and the sons bring a korban, a chatat anola, and the people bring a chatat anola, a special shlamim. And we'll see later why the states marked down Sefer Bamidbar. Now, if it's the same day, what happened on that day other than the Shekhinah returning? Something tragic happened on Yom HaShmini. What was that?
Not other than Avi.
No. What did they do wrong? Basically, what's going to say wrong? They did something that God did not command. Remember? They meant well. They had good intentions. Maybe they were more focused on themselves. God wasn't happy because God says, here's what you do. Moshe gathers the nation, tells them, this is what you need to do. And they take initiative on their own and they bring their own korban. Asher lo tziva otam. If you remember that pasuk in Shmini. What they did wrong is they did something not commanded. And they received a terrible punishment, which would make you think that taking initiative is not a good idea on that day. Now, what did the Nesim do on the same day? They take an initiative and they bring something that God didn't command. You ever pay attention to that? On the very same day that the Nesim bring their sacrifice that wasn't commanded, it's their idea to bring wagons. It's their idea to make a Kiddush. On the same day, Nadav and Avihu brought fire and they got a terrible punishment. Now, logically, what do you think came first? Think of it. I'm sure you never thought about it, right? Assuming they both happened on the same day, Nadav and Avihu brought their korban on Yom HaShmini, and the Nesim brought their korban on Yom HaShmini. They all brought, we'll see in a minute, they all, on the first day, they all bring it together, Yom HaKavta Mishkan. What makes sense came first?
The wagon.
The Nesim.
The Nesim, yeah.
Why would you say that?
They have to agree on it. They have to prepare for it. They have to decide that, yes, they're going to do
exactly.
it.
Exactly. That was planned way ahead of time, wasn't it? All those animals, that was well planned out.
And it went well.
And it went well. Okay. That's right. So I don't think they would have done it after Nadav and Avihu. I think exactly the opposite. The reason why Nadav and Avihu maybe did something, I think Chosha Dato Shel Nadav and Avihu because of the Nesim. Understand what I'm saying? The Nesim came and got all the action. They bring this big korban and they do something special. Now Nadav and Avihu want to do something. Now.
Right.
Now, what does God say? Take a look now at what God says. They can't bring the God has to okay it first. Let me just go back to Perek Zion. Let me make this bigger. What does God tell them? Again, on the same day, but Moshe puts the Mishkan together, he does the Mishicha and the Kadesh Otam. The Nesim come, I think, early in that day. And what do they bring? They bring the six wagons. And each one is 2 ox power. Listen what God tells Moshe. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe lemor, kach mi'itam. It's okay to take it. Moshe has to get permission to use it. And we can use it for the Levim to carry the Mishkan, which is easy. And now that they brought a korban, brought a present for the Levites to help them carry the Mishkan, and then what happens next? They also made a Kiddush, dedicating the Mizbech on the day that it was anointed. And then the Nesim brought the korban in front of the Mizbech, and we'll see, everyone brought the same thing on the first day. And God tells Moshe, instead of everyone bringing on the same day, but God says, slow down, one Nesi a day instead of everyone on the same day. And then we have, in parentheses, the 12 days. Got that? The 12 days. And on the last day, I mean, the last day is the 12th. When the 12 days are over, in parentheses, we go back to day one. Listen carefully. Zot Chanukat HaMizbeach B'yomi Mashachoto. This is not a summary of what was brought after 12 days. This is a summary of what was brought on the first day. On the first day, we brought everything together. And then God said, take this and divide it by 12. No, this isn't multiplication. This is division. I mean, on the first day, we bought all this. This we bought all on the first day. And God said, you give us one a day, you know, one nasi a day. But this happened on the first day. Got it? B'yomi mashachato. And then we have a list of 12 times everything. Got it? And then the last line, kol bakar zavach shemei simba b'parim, etc. Zot chanukat ha-mizbeach achrei mashachato. The last passage we'll leave later on.
No, wait a minute. So are you saying that all 12 Nesim showed up with all their stuff, and then God said, whoa, wait a minute, go back and bring it separately?
I'm not saying, Chumash says that. I didn't say that. That's what Chumash says. We just read it, didn't we? This is what they brought on the first day. This is it. Go back to the beginning. What did God say? They all bring it. Look what it says. In addition to the wagons, v'yakrivu ha'nesim et chanukat ha'mizbeach b'yom himashachoto. Got that? Remember, zot chanukat ha'mizbeach b'yom himashachoto. Let me share the other screen. I have it clear on the other one. Where are we? Here we go. Here's what it goes. V'yakrivu ha'nesim et chanukat ha'mizbeach b'yom himashachoto. And then what happens? Now we go back to our little toy here. Let's see if it's still working. Got it? I got my nice colors there. Okay.
Zot HaMizbeach B'yom HaMashachoto. I'm just going to ask you. I've lost you. Please translate what you're saying into English.
I'll translate. Okay. This, what the Nesim brought on the day it was dedicated, Right? And at the end of the chapter, after in parentheses, the 12 days, this is a summary of what was brought on the first day. And that's the list of 12 times everything. And what did God say? Instead of everyone bringing it on the same day, instead of a massive Kiddush, let's slow this down and have a 12-day Kiddush. Understand? That's what happened. But what's important to me, at the end of chapter 7, we're still on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Correct? Now, what's the last, in the meantime, after Chanukah Tanisim, we had the Korbanot, another of the died. Remember, and Aaron's not going to eat, etc. What's the last Avodah in the temple? What's the last thing we do in the daily service?
Lighting the menorah?
Exactly. The menorah is lit in the evening. In the morning, you come in and set it up. In the evening, you light it. Correct? And it lights from Erev Ad Boker. The last Avodah we do in the Mikdash is lighting the menorah. Got it? Now, who's supposed to light the menorah? Aaron. Has he ever lit it before? No. It's the first day that Aaron's lighting the menorah. Because it's the first day the mission is functioning. Now, in the meantime, what happened? None of the Neviu died. Understand? Now, remember what Aaron said? Aaron didn't eat the Korban that day, didn't he? Remember, he complained and Moshe said you were right? So what's the question now? After everything that happened, should Aaron light the menorah? Now look at Parakhet. You follow? Now in chapter 8, what happens? That explains Parsha Balotcha. Why does God have to command it again? Because it's not a commandment like in Parsha Truma Tetzaveh, the general commandment. This is ongoing narrative. This is a chronological narrative. We're still on day one. Did you follow that? Hope you follow that.
Not really. So wait.
I'll explain it again.
During the 8 days of Miluim, though, didn't they practice everything that they were supposed to do every day?
No, they assembled it and took it apart. But the Avodah Moshe was the Kohen every day. It didn't say anything about laying the menorah inside. That was only in the 7 days of Miluim. Moshe was the Kohen. And Aaron, Nadav, and Avihu brought their sacrifices. Aaron and his sons brought their sacrifices. The 7 days of Miluim. And then other things. But there was no, it doesn't mention anything about the other Avodah. It doesn't mention anything about lighting the menorah. The first time the menorah is going to be lit officially by the Kohen, because they're not Kohanim yet until the 7 days are over. On the seventh day, Aaron for the first time brings the Korban. That's the special sacrifices of Yom HaShmini. It's the first time Aaron's bringing a sacrifice by himself. During the 7 days of Miluim, Moshe is the officiating priest, and Aaron and Nadav are bringing their sacrifices, their Korban. But they don't officiate. Moshe sprinkles the blood. Moshe does all the tenufa and everything. The first time Aaron and his sons officiate in the temple is on Yom HaShmini, which is Rosh Chodesh Nisan, Yom HaKamat, the day that the Mishkan is set up. What I'm trying to show you is, if I follow the chronology, the first day anyone ever did Birkat Kohanim was on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, which is the end of Perek Vav, which belongs in Perek Zion, got it? This Birkat Kohanim belongs right here chronologically, because it's the first time they did it. And that happened with Yom HaShmini. It's going to happen because they're about to. This is when God tells Moshe in real time, here's what Aaron needs to do when he finishes his Avodah. We saw last week that's what happened. Didn't we see that last week? I'll go back there. I'll show you in a minute. And then in chapter 7, the Nesim out of nowhere decide on their own to make this beautiful present because they're thinking about others, not about themselves. They're helping the Levites. They're helping the people. They're giving wagons to the Levites. They're giving a free Kiddush to Am Yisrael to make this big celebration to dedicate the Mizbeach. And then on the 8th, and then when it's over, in the meantime, we have the Korban of Yom HaShmini and Nadav and Avihu die. And Aaron has this whole thing, what should he do? And that's why in chapter 8 now, we're still on the first day, God has to tell Aaron to light the menorah. And Aaron actually does it. He doesn't argue this time and say, no, I shouldn't do it. Now, just to remind you, in case you forgot what happened on Yom HaShmini, let's go back real fast to Sefer Vayikra, Perek Tet. I'm going to show you the Birkat Kohanim happened there. On Yom HaShmini, Moshe called everyone together, all the elders, etc., and told them, now here's the Korban you bring. And what's the keyword? And Moshe tells the people, Zeh hadavar asher tzivah Hashem tasu. This is what God commanded. And God's glory will appear to you, Kvod Hashem. And we saw the end of Shvot, Kvod Hashem came on that day, on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And then Moshe tells Aaron, bring your special korban. When he finishes the korban, at the chazot, etc., he finishes all the sacrifice work, as God commanded him. And then Vaisar Ronet Yadav, Elam Vaivarchem. That's Birkat Kohanim. And then he finishes the thing. And then Moshe and Aaron go inside, and the Shekhinah comes. Okay, the Shekhinah comes, is the thing. And Esh comes, eats the Korban, and then Nadav and Avihu happened. And after Nadav and Avihu, remember, at the end of that story, Aaron, Moshe gets angry at Aaron. Okay, how come you didn't eat the Mincha, or the thing? And Aaron tells him, what do you call it? What's Aaron say? And Aaron tells Moshe, is this the right thing to do after what happened to me today? I'm going to eat Chatat today? And Moshe says, okay, but how about laying the menorah? So that's my point. That's my explanation for why Parsha Baluch is where it is. It's in chronological order. It's the first time Aaron lights the menorah because that's the last avodah on that day. And it's a chiddush, he has to light the menorah even though he lost his son that day. I want to put that in its chronological context. Okay. That was the first part. That's the first Hanukkah, which has to do with Kohanim. And it's what I'm getting at is that the very first Hanukkah is a mixture between national leadership. Because again, why is this story in Sefer Bamidbar? It's why do we have all this? Let's go back a little bit. Why are we having all this details in Sefer Bamidbar? For a good reason, because in Sefer Bamidbar, we're traveling from Har Sinai to the land of Israel. We're traveling with the Mishkan. We can't travel until the Mishkan is ready. Now the Mishkan is ready. We're going to travel with the Mishkan, and the Levites have to carry it. And therefore, the Nesim give the wagons, and the topic here is the wagons that they're donating, and the political leadership of the people. The same people are going to lead the army. Remember? The Nasi, remember, Nasi Echad L'Tzei Echad L'Yom? We have political leadership who's going to lead the army. We said that in the first four chapters. Together with the religious leadership. And who remembers what happens in Hanukkah? On Hanukkah, the Kohanim are also the political leaders, which the rabbis aren't so happy with. Maybe in the beginning it was okay, but they kept that status too long. Okay, now that we have that's the first, I was about to show you is the first Hanukkah. It's Hanukkah HaMizbeach. It's the altar. The Mizbeach is dedicated by the political leaders who are about to take their army and conquer the land and establish sovereignty in the land. And at the same time, it's in the context of the special korbanot of Yom HaShmini, where Aaron has to do Birkat Kohanim, where the Kohanim are involved, and Aaron has to light the menorah. So we have Chanukat HaMizbeach together with Kohanim lighting the menorah. Got the idea? So we'll see later how that's going to help explain what happens in the time of the Chashmonaim. So that's part one. Now we can stop the share and go to part two. Hope I didn't lose. Okay, we'll see now. What's part two? So that's, again, that's why this is the Torah reading for Hanukkah, not just the word Hanukkah, but the whole theme of Hanukkah is here. And now I want to go back to now I want to start with the universal holiday. I'm going to read a Gemara, which I'm assuming you're familiar with, so I'll just explain it quickly. For those who aren't aware, there's a tractate called Avodah Zarah, which is about idol worship. Now, why would we have a tractate about idol worship? We're not supposed to worship idols. So there's a really strange law that we're not allowed to do business deals with idol worshipers close to the holidays, because a businessman would love to make a deal with with a Jewish entrepreneur. And if we land a deal with a idol worshiper on their holidays, what are they going to do? They're going to thank their idol, their God, for landing the deal, and that's going to promote idol worship. So therefore, the opening mission says, you can't make a business deal with an idol worshiper on their holidays. Therefore, to be a firm Jewish businessman, you need to know the idol worship holidays. And therefore, the next mission talks about, these are the holidays of the idol worshippers, and the first two we talk about are Kalanda and Saturna. So what's Kalanda? Sounds like the word calendar. The 8 days after the winter solstice, in our calendar, that'll be from December 21st to December 28th, or 22nd to 29th. And Saturn is 8 days before the winter solstice, or December 17th to the 24th. Okay? Now the Gemara is going to tell you a beautiful midrash about how these holidays came about. going back to Adam HaRishon. Now, I'll add a little maybe humor to it. Adam HaRishon got a really nice watch from his father-in-law. And remember the wedding? They got married, or they got Noah's to marry, but they were created and got married and everything on Tishrei, which means their first couple months together, and they were in the Northern Hemisphere, because in Gan Eden must be the land of Israel, wherever it is. They're in the Northern Hemisphere. And what's he notice? Ton Rabbanan. Lefishra Adam HaRishon Yom Shemikmet Polech. He was looking at his watch every day, every week or so, and noticed that the days are getting shorter and shorter. He finished Shacharit, it's time for Mincha. He said, what's going on here? And he's good in math. And what does he realize? There's this progression going on. And he realized, if this continues, it's going to get, you know, soon, as soon as the sun rises, it's going to set, there'll be no more light. So he gets, he knew Yiddish. Amar Oili. He said, woe is to me. Shema Bishros Sarachti Alum Chashuch Badi. Maybe because I sinned, that's why things are getting dark. And now, you know what? When God told me if I eat from that apple, I'm going to die, and I didn't die yet, he doesn't know what death is yet. Maybe death is a lack of light. And therefore, before there was light, everything was tohu vavohu, was whatever that means. No order. And then God said that there be light. Maybe the lack of light is death. And when God said, you're going to die, he's going to take light away, and he's doing a slow death. No. Instead of accepting that, what does he do? He said, v'zehu mitan, that's the death that God punished me with when I didn't listen to him. What does he do? Amar v'yashav chet yamin betanitu tefillah. He davened and fasted for 8 days. And after 8 days of fasting and davening, what does he notice? He looks at his watch. Kivan shra tkuvat tebet. He realized the days are starting to get longer. They're not getting shorter anymore. He reached the winter solstice. V'ra yom shemarich vodech. He saw the days getting longer and longer. Amar min hagosh olamo. Ah, that's nature. It's not my punishment, and I'm still alive. What does he do? He's a chassid. Halach v'asa shmoni yamim tovim. He made an 8 day holiday. So he fasted for 8 days. God answered his prayer, and he makes a party for 8 days. L'shana acheret, the next year. Remember this phrase, l'shana acheret, the next year. He did both of them yom tovim. The 8 days he fasted was a holiday because God answered his prayer, and the 8 days that he celebrated, Kal v'chomer celebrates. So every year, Adam HaRishon made a winter solstice holiday, 8 days before the solstice and 8 days after the solstice. Now, he started the holidays. Who kabam l'shem shamayim? He did it for Shem Shamayim, for God's sake. Behem, his children, went off to Derech. Heim kabum l'shem avodat kochabim. So basically what this Midrash is saying is that the source of these two holidays are winter solstice holidays. Now, we're not going to do, let me just check the chat real fast to make sure I didn't miss anything. Okay, those are the sources. That's fine. That we'll get the word menorah, we'll get to later on. Okay, that's fine. So let's continue now. I want to show you, based on what we did, the similarities between the famous Gemara Masechet Shabbat about Chanukah that we're all familiar with, and how it's similar, it echoes this Midrash about Adam HaRishon. Okay. Torah Rabbanan, Mitzvah Chanukah, Ner Ishu Beito. What was the original custom of Hanukkah? Maybe even preceded Hanukkah. What do we do? Every person, every household lights a candle. Yeah, not a Chanukiah, not a menorah, simply like a Yahrzeit candle. One candle in every home. We light a candle in every home for, we'll see, for 8 days. What did the Mahadran do? The Mahadran lit a candle for every person. Okay. And the famous Mahadran Mina Mahadran, Beit Shammai says, we start on the first day with 8 candles and go down to 1, 8, 7, 6 to 1. And Beit Hillel says we start on the first day with 1 and we add a candle every day till we get to 8. Got that? Now, doesn't that sound like the 8 days before the solstice, 8 days after the solstice? Was counting up 8 days or counting down 8 days or getting darker and darker for 8 days? Beit Shammai, always on the more pessimistic side. And getting lighter 8 days, which is Beit Hillel, the more optimistic side. But you see an echo of other, of that Gemara about Adam HaRishon, of the 8 days before and 8 days after, and the basic laws of Hanukkah, the Machloka Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Now, then we have the famous story of my Hanukkah. There's a Girsa, which I forget where they found it, but there's, which most likely is a much more accurate Girsa. Not my Hanukkah, not what's the reason for Hanukkah, but my Ner Hanukkah. What's the reason why we light candles on Hanukkah? Because the reason for Hanukkah is the military victory. What's the question? Why do we light candles on Hanukkah? In light of that, the Gemara brings Megillat Tanit, the law that the 8 days of Hanukkah, you don't do hespedim and you don't fast. And the famous story when the Yevanim, when the Greeks came into the temple, all the shemen, all the oil was defiled. And when we went and we found one little thing of oil, everyone knows the story, with the stamp of the Kohen Gadol, had an OU on it. And remember the miracle, okay, loya bo, in the oil container, there was only enough oil in that container to light the menorah for one day. And the miracle was not in the menorah, the miracle was in the pach. That should be crystal clear. I mean, if the miracle, the menorah did not light for 8 days. I know the Maccabee song sings it different. In most of the songs, they say, you know, we lit the menorah and it lasted for 8 days. It didn't last for 8 days. The menorah was lit in the evening and lasted till the morning. And the mitzvah is to light it every day in the evening. And if it's still lit in the morning, you extinguish it and set it up and get the wicks ready and the oil ready. And you don't light it till the evening. You do what's called haptava. You clean it up and get it ready in the morning. In the evening, you light it, and it lights from evening to morning. So the miracle was not in the menorah. The miracle was in the pach. Remember, it's Loshon Zachar, Lasabones. Vidliko mimeno shmone yamin. That little oil container had enough oil to last for 8 days. Rabbi Zak, if you were in the Hebrew Shirim, I think, I'm sure he gave I remember the title, so I'm sure he talked about that. This is like a classic miracle that happened several times in Tanakh. Where someone down and depressed and needs help, the miracle happens within the container of oil. So again, the miracle is in the oil container, not with the menorah. Now, what's important for me now, look at the next day. L'shana acheret, the next year, they decided to make it a Yom Tov, v'halo and hodaya. We see the parallel, we have 8 days and 8 days, going up or going down, and we started, and then the next year, something happened 1 year, and the next year we make it a holiday. So I just, again, there's an echo between them. I want to give a reason for it as we go on.
Purim.
Now we have to talk about the winter solstice, and I want to tie all these things together. I want to explain why Hanukkah is a universal holiday. So there's no doubt the Adam Arishon story is a winter solstice holiday. And we'll see later Saturnalia was a big Roman holiday. It's well known that it's a big idol worship holiday. Saturna, what the Gemara calls, was well known at the time of the rabbis. It was like the biggest pagan holiday the Romans had. I'll give you a Wikipedia later for Saturnalia. And the fact that we have, in that context, we have a Gemara about lighting Hanukkah candles, which is very similar, with 8 days going up, 8 days going down, and this phrase, the Shana Cheret, at least indicates to me that there's some connection between them. Now, let's go back to this idea of a winter solstice. And first, let's explain why it doesn't make sense I would have a winter solstice on our lunar calendar, because our calendar is lunar. And therefore, we don't have a winter solstice because we don't have December 21st. We have 12 months a year. And the winter solstice could be any time could be in Kislev, it could be in Tevet. Now, but our calendar is not only lunar, it's also solar in the sense that the first month has to include the spring equinox. That's called a Chodesh Zelachem. And therefore, what does Beit Din decide? Beit Din, after 12 months are over, or towards the end of the 12th month, they check the calendar, they check they're aware of the solar calendar. And if the spring equinox is not going to fall out in the month of Nisan, they add a month. And therefore, by definition, the spring equinox is always going to be in the first month of our Jewish calendar. Now, it might be anywhere in that month. There's a whole range of 30 days it might be in. The spring equinox has to fall out in the first month, which means the winter solstice is 9 months later, which means it will fall out either in the ninth or tenth month of our Jewish calendar. Everyone follow that? We don't know the exact date of the winter solstice, but the winter solstice has to fall out in either the ninth month or tenth month. The math is real easy because month number one always has to include the spring equinox. 9 months later, is going to be, 9 months later, not 270 days later, 270 days afterwards is going to be the winter solstice. Therefore, the winter solstice, by definition, is going to fall either in the ninth month or tenth month, or either in Kislev or Tevet. Now comes what I want to, maybe call it a chiddush if you want. The winter solstice is not only the shortest day of the year. It's also the longest night, which sounds like the same thing. But there's a difference between the longest night and the darkest night. What I want to claim is the winter solstice in our calendar is better than the solar calendar. We have a better winter solstice than the solar calendar because it can be December 21st and you can have a full moon, which means it might be a long night, but there's light out. I want to look for the darkest nights of the year. Now, if you remember, if you're paying attention to, we all keep Shabbos. In July, from the middle of August till the end of September, Shabbos got earlier 10 minutes a week, wasn't it? Every week, Shabbos was getting 10 minutes earlier, at least on the Northern Hemisphere. Now, all of a sudden, in mid-November, what happens? It's pretty much the same now. It's going to change 1 or 2 minutes a week, and that's it. But pretty much, it's the earliest Shabbos now from now for the next 2 months. Meaning, you can do the math why that happens. They're asking an astronomer why that is. It has to do with the tilt of the Earth. And, and now how the Earth goes, I forget whether the Earth goes around the sun or the sun around the Earth. I forget what we paskin by nowadays. But it has to do with astronomy. And basically, the shortest days pretty much are the same amount of time for about a month and a half, for 2 months, from the middle, but basically from December and January, or actually from the end of November to the middle of January, they're pretty much the same short day. What changes, though, is the moon. And therefore, if I'm looking for the darkest nights of the year, I want the nights when there's no moon. Now, the new moon begins on the first or second of the month is the new moon. It's out for, half an hour or so. On the second of the month already, the moon is out, or the third day of the month, the moon is out for an hour and a half, and it's getting bigger. The third day, it's out before sunset for, it's 45 minutes every day more. By the time you get to the 15th, the moon's out all night long. I'm just giving you, it's basic astronomy, which you should be familiar with. Meaning, the first 2 weeks of the month, after the first 2 days, the moon is out at the beginning of the night, and it's bigger and bigger every day. Now, in the second half of the month, the moon doesn't rise until after sunset, way after sunset. The moon doesn't rise until the sun can set and the moon doesn't rise for an hour, for 2 hours, for 3 hours. By the last week of the month, the moon doesn't rise till after midnight and it's getting smaller and smaller. And the last 5-6 days of the month, the moon is rising. They get 3 in the morning and it's getting smaller and smaller. So if I'm looking for the 8 darkest nights of the year on my Jewish solar lunar calendar, or put it this way, the 8 darkest days of any month are the last week, the last 6 days, and the first 2 days of the next month. The last 6 days of the previous month, and Rosh Chodesh, and the first day. Those are the darkest nights of any month. It's the last week. Now, if I want to put the winter solstice being the darkest nights of the year, so I need something either in the 9th month or the 10th month, but after looking when there's no moon, because the last week of any month is the darkest month, the darkest week of that month. So simply put the winter solstice, the last week of the night going through the 10th, which is exactly Hanukkah, isn't it? I hope you followed that, maybe. What I'm trying to say is that the last week of the 9th month going through the 10th, which is exactly the dates of Hanukkah, are the 8 darkest nights of the year, which is way better than the winter solstice December 21st date, if I'm looking for the darkest nights of the year, because I could have a full moon. On our 8 days of Hanukkah, there's no moon. Maybe at 3 in the morning. You can check it out. If you get up early in the morning, you don't see the moon until 2-3 in the morning. Tonight already, you'll look, the moon won't rise to about way after midnight. And it's only, less than half full. And it's going to get darker and darker every night, and the moon smaller and smaller. Till Rosh Chodesh in the first day of the month, which is almost no moon at all. After that, it starts getting lighter and lighter. So what I want to claim is the 8 darkest nights of the year are exactly the 8 nights of Hanukkah. And don't be surprised at what's our original custom of every family lighting a candle, Ner Ishu Beito. So it makes sense to me that there was a very logical custom in Jewish homes that during the 8 darkest nights of the year, or the winter solstice in our calendar, which is a much better winter solstice than the December 21st date because it's not much the darkest nights of the year. What do? We light candles. Instead of being depressed or getting drunk like other cultures do in the darkest time of the year. We light candles, and we'll see later why it's a symbol of hope. Now, if that's the case, then the meaning of lighting candles on the darkest nights of the year is a theme which is universal. It makes sense that we mark the winter solstice in our holiday calendar. Makes perfect sense, even if it wasn't for the holiday of Hanukkah and the military victory. Now we have to see why is Hanukkah this time of year. So that was part two. I'm going to run out of time. Oh my gosh. So let me get to part three real quick so I don't lose. We'll have to finish this next week to get the Hanukkah story. But now comes the fun part. So I explained the winter solstice on the Jewish calendar. I'll just share with you Saturnalia. Again, this is the source in on the web where I got it from a long time ago. But I want to show you that what the Gemara is talking about was well known. The Roman pagans first introduced the holiday of Saturnalia, a week-long period of lawlessness celebrated between like the last 8 days of the it's basically the winter solstice holiday. And Roman courts were closed. It's like Purim almost, the Havdil, the way it shouldn't be celebrated. Where in Roman law, if you did damage to someone else, you wouldn't be punished because it's expected that people get hurt. It's like a wild party. Okay. And Lucian wrote in his thing about they did human sacrifice. They everyone got drunk. They went house singing and other things I shouldn't even mention. But they were basically wild parties. Now, in the 4th century, when Constantine, remember, takes over the Roman Empire and turns a Christian. So he's trying to make a bunch of pagans Christian. And he can't get them to stop Saturnalia because it's like stopping Purim. You can give 1,000 shiurim. Once you have a custom of people getting drunk in a winter holiday, you can't change customs so fast. So what do? They changed Saturnalia into a Christian holiday. And they made up a medrash that he was born on the last day. But in their sources, they know this very well. He wasn't born then. There's no source of being born then. He was born, I think, in the spring in their sources. But they turned Saturnalia into Christmas. And that's why, because there's nothing Christian about Saturnalia, but they turned it, the leaders said Saturnalia's last day was his birthday. Now, what's really cool, the Christian, the clergy knew this back in the, they knew this very well. And there were some people didn't like this idea. And if you look in your history, this is really cool. Because of its pagan origin, Christmas was banned by the Puritans in Massachusetts between 1659 and 1681. It's a long time. But you couldn't stop the people's customs, though, and it came back in. And this guy, Reverend Mather, he makes he writes it in his memoirs that the he said the reason wasn't because he was born then, but it was Saturnalia, and they tried to make it into a Christian holiday. So that's the source. So therefore, what I'm getting at? On the universal side, it's not by chance that Christmas is in the winter solstice holiday, because it's originally Saturnalia. And it's not by chance that Hanukkah is this time of year, but it's a totally different way of celebrating. So therefore, what I'm pointing out, it's not by chance that they're the same time of year. Now we have to what makes it a Jewish holiday. And that goes to Haggai, and we can only start with that, and then we'll have to continue this next week and do it properly. We have to go to the beginning of the Second Temple period. We'll do this properly next week and do the whole history. But we'll go back to Ezra and do this properly. I simply want to open up the book of Haggai. Just to refresh your memory, the Second Temple period begins when the Persians defeat the Babylonians, as Yirmiyahu predicted. And the Persian first emperor, or the first king, is called Cyrus the Great. And he changes Roman policy and allows all the ethnic groups in his empire to go back to their homelands and build their temples and hopes they'll be good Persian citizens. And it works. Among the people who were allowed to return were the Jews in Babylonian exile. And they had the right to return back to Israel. And some people actually make Aliyah, other people send money. They come to Israel in the first and second year of Koresh. And instead of building the temple, we have what's called the First Intifada. We'll discuss this next week. And for the next 18 years, there's a building freeze. And the people who came and made Aliyah are down and depressed. And their attitude is, God doesn't want us here. And now they're politically in trouble because the local population, most of the people living in Jerusalem at the time are not Jewish. They can't get their temple off the ground. The local leaders won't let them. We'll see, the economy is a disaster. And the people are saying, basically, God doesn't want us. It's the fact that politically things are falling apart. The fact that there's a building freeze. And the fact that we can't make a living. And there's no rain. And there's a drought. God's telling us he doesn't want us. Along comes Haggai. In the first year, the second year of the reign of the new administration, King Darius, Daryavish, Darius the Great, which is about 18 years later. When he comes into power, Haggai says, this is an opportunity to start building again. And he tells the people are saying, it's not time to build. It's not time to build. And the Navi says, it is time to build. You get to work on the temple. And Haggai promises him again, we'll see you next week. If you build a temple and start working on it, all your problems will be solved. The people think we're not building because God doesn't want us here. And God's telling them through the Navi, you have it exactly wrong. God's not saying I don't want you here. I want you to work harder on the temple and get started on it. If you do that, your economy will get better and your sovereignty will return. And that's Haggai's message when they break ground on the temple. Now, his opening nevuah is on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. He gives another nevuah about Israel can be great again on the last day of Sukkot. We'll read next week. And the same time, Zechariah, the Haftarah for Hanukkah, which we'll do in next week's share, is Borni V'Simchi Bat Zion. That's exactly the second year of Dayavesh, as Haggai is trying to encourage them to build a temple. The people are down and depressed, and therefore the Navi tells them to be happy. Now, why is this so important? Because he starts getting them, he starts this initiative and tries to motivate the people in Rosh Chodesh Nisan, in the second year of Dayavesh. Almost 2 months later, the last day of Sukkot, he gives them another fiery speech, tells them to get moving, get your plans ready with great promises. And they finally break ground on the temple on the 24th of Kislev. So the 24th of Kislev, they break ground on the temple. And he tells the people, pay attention to your ways, or pay attention to what's going on. On the day before they start construction of the temple, we see that there's a big ceremony as they're about to begin construction. This construction began on the 24th or 25th, you could argue. But he says, pay attention to this day, from the 24th day of the ninth month, which is Erev Hanukkah, which is our first candle, because we light candles in the evening. So we're lighting from the 24th going to the 25th. The day that Yusarei Chel Hashem, pay attention to the day that the foundations of the second temple are being laid. Up until this time, your produce is terrible. From this day, I'm going to bless your produce. And then he gives another nevuah on the same day, tells Zerubbabel there's going to be a big political upheaval. Things are going to change. Big armies are going to fall. And when it's over, you're going to come back to sovereignty. He alludes to it later we'll see why he alludes to it. Now, what I want to explain is the people in the beginning of Beit Sheni are down and depressed, have every reason to be that. For some reason, I'm sorry, let me stop the share. For some reason, Haggai is going to have a groundbreaking ceremony in the middle of the winter on the 24th of Kislev. And it's going to take 4 years till they finish building. They don't finish till the sixth year. What I want to ask is, I don't think it's by chance that they break ground on the 24th of Kislev. Rather, they're breaking ground at the darkest time of the year. Like the darkest week of the year. Because, as they say, I think in English, you can't get any worse. It can only get better. There's a phenomenon in nature called the winter solstice, which represents Haggai's spiritual message. That no matter how dark it is, things can get better. If you go back to the Adam HaRishon approach, remember the Midrash? Of Adam says it's getting worse and worse and worse. And Adam wants to almost giving up hope. And then he turns around and davens and prays and things turn around. If I take that background, Haggai is purposely making the groundbreaking ceremony at the darkest time of the year with the point that even though things are really down and depressed and things are bad, things can get better again. And therefore, I think he picks the day of the 24th of Kislev, and they start building on the 25th, in order to encourage the people and give the message of things can only get better, and there's light at the end of the tunnel. Now, Haggai's prophecies aren't fulfilled in his own lifetime, because the people don't do as much as they should have. We'll see next week, the first time that his prophecies of return to sovereignty and prosperity happen are in the time of the Hashmonaim. And then we'll see that they purposely picked that day to dedicate the temple. It wasn't the battle ended on that day. The battle ended way earlier. They're going to build a whole new temple, as we'll see next week. And they're going to pick, we'll see in Sefer Maccabim, that that day is picked on purpose to dedicate the temple. It wasn't like a last minute thing. It was well thought out. And my claim is the date of Hanukkah. Let me get back. I'll finish with my title and we'll explain the details of it later next week. My title is that Hanukkah begins as the universal time of year of light in times of darkness, where things are dark, but things can get better. Haggai picks the day. The day is special before this story, before the military victory, before it became a national holiday. It's a holiday of hope on an important time of the year. It's hope that one day, by Shani, can be great again. One day we can return to sovereignty and be God's people again and do it right. But the day is a day of hope, not a day of celebration yet. It's a day of hope that things can get better to motivate the people. Those prophecies are fulfilled with the miracles of the and the battles of the Hashmonaim. And once they rededicate the temple, it becomes a national holiday until the temple is destroyed. So for the last 200 years of the Second Temple period, Hanukkah is a national holiday because that's when we got our sovereignty back. After the temple is destroyed, there's no reason to celebrate a national holiday. And therefore, Hanukkah, like all the other dates in Megillat Tanit, should all become nullified. The rabbis decided to keep the holiday, or maybe we'll see, the people decided to keep the holiday. But once you're keeping the holiday, it's no longer a national holiday. It returns now to become a holiday of hope that maybe one day we'll return to sovereignty again and get it right. And therefore, after the Korban, the whole focus of the holiday moves from the military victory to the miracle of the menorah and Pach HaShemen. And that we have to explain why next week, why specifically that miracle and the message of the menorah is going to answer the problem of what went wrong with Hasmonean revolt. The Hasmoneans got off to a good start, but things went bad. And if we're going to continue to celebrate Hanukkah, we're not only going to thank God for what happened in the past, it's also going to be a holiday of hopes for a better future, but knowing what to do with our sovereignty when we get it back again. Again, this we have to explain next week much more in detail when we see Haggai and Zechariah, and we see the time period, but Zechariah is going to give a message which is going to balance Haggai, and that's going to be the nevuah of the menorah and Zechariah, of lo b'chayav lo b'koach, and the need, on the one hand, to have a national holiday to celebrate our military victory and return to sovereignty. But on the other hand, after it's lost, to continue celebrating it by itself makes no sense. But to celebrate as a holiday of hope of maybe one day returning to sovereignty and returning to temple worship, then the focus of the holiday will be to make sure the message is right. The focus of the holiday will return to the theme of the menorah and the meaning, the deeper meaning of the Nes Pach HaShemen. So let me just go back to my title. Hanukkah begins as a universal holiday in the time. It's the time of year of the winter solstice, which decadent societies get drunk and go wild. In Judaism, it's a time of hope and light. And even though representing times of darkness in our history, things can get better and not to give up hope. Like good old Yechezkel's Rabbonz Nebuah. Historically, it becomes a national holiday when we return to our sovereignty exactly this time of year. But this time of year was picked because of the date from the Haggai, because it was a time of hope back then. It becomes a national holiday. After we lose our sovereignty, it's no longer a national holiday, but it becomes a religious holiday right. at an important time of the year in our universal calendar as a holiday of hope and the message of the menorah of what to do with your sovereignty once you have it. And we'll see later next week how important it is to, like, breathing to the situation we're in today, where we return to sovereignty. And we'll see later why the symbol of the state of Israel beautifully is the menorah from Zechariah. So I'll stop here because my time's up. And let me take questions real fast. We'll work backwards. Let's see. Go back to the beginning. But it was okay. The reason by re-celebrating Sukkot that year, we'll see next week when we talk about Sefer Maccabim. That's in 2 Maccabees. Okay, we have the winter solstice. Okay, Sukkot is there is in 2 Maccabees, there's a connection between Sukkot and Hanukkah, which relates to the universal side of it, but we'll discuss that next week as well. When and where did the word menorah come from? Instead of Hanukkiah. Oh, a Hanukkiah, there's no name Hanukkiah in Chumash, I'm pretty sure. Hanukkiah is a name we make up for they can't rely on the menorah. The menorah's idea of giving light is from Chumash, from the word ner, I'm pretty sure. You put a mem in front of a, I'm sure the source is the word ner, and menorah is something that has a lot of candles on it. And here the source is okay, but they, for religious reasons, want light from the candles, other lights, and moon nature. Wait, I didn't understand our Pat's question. We'll get back to that in a minute. Kind of like Vahavdil. Okay, yeah. When people have been hugging, you can't get rid of them. Rabbi Jay is saying that when the masses do something, you can't get rid of it. But instead, what you do, it might be a bad minug. I mean, Kodri is a good minug, but once it's a minug, then you have to find a good reason for it or make up a good reason for it and turn it into something. Like, the reason now becomes, gives meaning to a custom that might have been for who knows what reason. Okay. Agriculture at winter solstice. Okay. There's an agricultural side to Hanukkah as well. The end of the olive harvest. Rabbi Elbanun has a really nice shir on that, which relates to this, but I can do that. I can present this without that part. That only adds to it. And enlightening. Thank you. And yeshua. Okay. Any questions in, any other questions in
audio,
person?
Audio questions.
Audio questions. Yeah.
Just a technical question. If I understood you correctly, when Moshe Rabbeinu officiated the first 7 days, but the Mizbeah had not yet been anointed. It was anointed with oil only on the eighth day. Is that correct?
That's what Chumash says.
Ah, okay. I just wanted to confirm that that's what you were pointing out.
Yeah. Now, they were using the Mizbeah, but it was officially dedicated on the eighth day. The 7 days where they put it together and took it apart, they were practicing. But the Gemara talks about, the Gemara has a whole discussion. Did Moshe wear Bigdei Kuhuna during those 7 days? There's also in Zvachim on that. Did Moshe wear, what clothes did Moshe wear during the 7 days of Elohim? And after 7 days of Elohim, was Moshe allowed to bring Korbanot again? Was that a one-time thing? Did Moshe have the status of a Kohen only for 7 days? Or he kept that status? There's also, again, that what Begedi Moshe wore and things like that. That's all. But there's no doubt that Gemara for sure explains that, that during those 7 days, Moshe did all the Avodah. Chumash says so. And the first time Aaron does Avodah is on the eighth day. And that's why the eighth day is so important. But what I try to show you in the beginning of the year today, that when you look at the realities of it, that on the same day the Nesim take initiative, which must have been planned ahead of time, later that day, none of a Nevi'u died. And that puts a damper on the whole day, which explains why we need a special commandment for Aaron to light the menorah, despite what happened. That's not critical for the defense of Hanukkah. I think it's critical to understand the laning we're going to start tomorrow and what's happening in Sefer Bamidbar. Now, in Bamidbar, there's a whole theme of political leadership and failure of political leadership, but that's for a series in Sefer Bamidbar. But relates to Hanukkah.
Question.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so the near Hanukkah, the Nes of Ner Hanukkah did happen, but it was celebrated only in the Beit HaMikdash all this time until Babel, when it was instituted to every house.
Okay, so,
and it
so
became the major thing.
Yeah. But if I remember, I'm pretty sure Rabbi Zak talked about that. I want to say as follows. I'll give you an analogy. How many people know about the miracle of the menorah? Who would know about it? The Kohen filling up. There's two Kohanim who are going to know about it. The Kohen who's filling up the menorah every day, right? That knows, hey, it's not empty. And the Kohen who snuck, the little Kohen, the kid who snuck in the night and filled it up. That was my joke. Maybe you got the joke. But what I'm getting at, it's not a miracle that anyone knows about other than a couple Kohanim. A couple of priests in the temple know about it. No one sees the miracle. Even the Kohanim don't see the miracle. The miracle is in a closed, it's in the Pach. It's a miracle, what's called, miracles happen, they're hidden from the eye. It's a hidden miracle. And the menorah was lit every day in the normal way. Now, if you were reading the paper during the time of the Hashmonaim, the front page stories for the whole week would be the Hasmonean victory. The Jews beat the Greeks, big military victory, like the Six-Day War kind of stuff. That's the front lines. In the Sunday Times religion section, there'll be a feature article. Okay. Rumors of a miracle in the temple. Got it? It's not, the miracle of the menorah is not a reason to celebrate forever for 8 days. It's not the reason for the holiday. The reason for the holiday is a military victory, and that would be reason enough even if it wasn't for the miracle of the menorah. Now, but what the Marsha says, a lot of Parshim say, the miracle of the menorah is not the Siba, it's a Siman. Was that military victory simply by chance, or was that divine? And the fact that God allowed a miracle to happen in the Mikdash during the time of that dedication, sometime when they dedicated the temple, there was this miracle with the menorah. How exactly it happened, you can argue. But the fact a miracle took place in the menorah that the Kohanim knew about, that was a sign to the rabbis that there's something divine about the victory, and we can make this an eternal celebration. Not just the celebration that year, but a celebration the next year and the year after, etc. I need a siman from God. The siba is a military victory, the reason. The siman, the sign from God, that it's divine, this victory, and God's behind it, that's the miracle of the menorah. Now, therefore, it's enough for the rabbis to make the holiday. 100 years later, the question comes up, but why continue celebrating Hanukkah after the Romans took over and destroyed the temple, and we have no sovereignty left, and we lost the big revolt? So if we're going to celebrate the holiday, it's going to be a holiday of hope, and the symbol of that hope will be that lighting the menorah. We'll see that later in Josephus, in next week's share. Hope that's clear. So I'm not doubting whether that miracle happened or not. In my opinion, it's irrelevant whether it happened. But the fact that when we see next week the meaning of Zechariah's Nevuah and Haftar for Hanukkah, the deeper meaning of not just Nesbach of the miracle, but where the miracle happens with the menorah and the message of the menorah, especially in light of Zechariah and the message of Bayit Sheni and what went wrong in Bayit Sheni, the need to balance, we'll see the balance next week, talk about the balance between military strength and victory and what you do with your military strength. And what do you do with your sovereignty? And what do you do with your prosperity? And how the menorah is going to be the message of Lo B'chayav Lo B'koach. Well, that'll help explain it much better.
Did you posit an explanation as to why the Nesi'im, who did something without being told to do it, had what they did accepted, whereas Nodav and Abihu did not?
Yeah, what I want to claim is that in Sefer Bamidbar, there's a lot of initiatives. Some really good ones, some really bad ones. Bnot Tzofchad, thumbs up. Pesach Sheni, thumbs up. Korach, thumbs down. Nodav and Abihu, thumbs down. Now, there are times for initiative and times not to take initiative. Now, the question is, when you take initiative, why are you doing it? Are you doing it because you want all this? I want to be Kohen Gadol. I want to part in the play kind of thing. I want everyone to look at me, or am I doing initiative to help other people? So Korach's initiative is a bad one because it's all about him. When you learn to think in depth, none of the view, it's all about them. They want to, and they're told not to do that. They do it anyhow for all the different reasons, but it's about them. They're not doing it to help anybody else. Where the Nesim, what are they doing? They're thinking about the Levites. They're thinking about the people. They're doing something for other people. And when initiatives are about other people, or Pesach Sheni, we want to be part, we don't want to miss out, we want part of our national celebration, but we want to be part of the nation, we want to join in this. Or Bnot Tzofchad, they want to part of the land. When initiatives are for the sake of a greater cause, that's fine. That's to be what's called the Shem Shemayim. But initiatives are out because it's all about me. And I think the best way, in modern day initiatives, I think it's the same litmus test. When you have a group of people wanting to so-called push the envelope and things like that, what's their underlying motivation? Is it all about, I want attention, I want to be famous, I want to be, I want to get the headlines, or I really want to do something to help the Jewish people and bring them closer to God? So you can argue how to make that happen, but the underlying motivation of initiatives is always important.
Thank you.
The problem is it's impossible to know today people's motives. It's very nice if God wants to send a sign like he did in the time of the Torah. Yeah. But hey, we have no right to judge other people's motives. We don't even know our own motives for doing things half the time. So it's like, I agree with you. There is, and the Netziv Chuvin Lishma can, and the Netziv has a powerful, frightening tshuva that the contradiction between whether it's great to do things with the wrong motivation, right? Lolam yasokata mitor mitzvah shalolishma, for the wrong reason, because from doing it for the wrong reason, you'll come to the right reason. Who cares what the reason is? You're doing the right thing. That's a famous gemara, lolishma balishma. But then there's another gemara, that says if you do things shelo lishma, would have been better had you not been born. So Tosfot always answers, well, it depends if you're doing it to rebel or to show somebody up for a very negative. But the Netziv has this like a frightening tshuva 150 years ago, that if you're innovating, whenever you're doing something, you have to do, the Torah says so, the rabbis say so, okay, who cares what motive? I have to do it, I have no choice. So even my motive is totally personal, it's okay. But if I'm doing something that I want to initiate and bring in a new idea, innovate, then I have to do it lishma. I remember Rav Schechter and Shear saying that some guy writes a sefer. So why is he writing a sefer? Who asked him to write a sefer? So you better make sure you're writing a sefer lishma, not to write it to get your name out there and to go on the speaker circuit, whatever. You have to write it because you want to spread Torah. It's very difficult. I don't know how anybody can live up to this. And first of all, if we know, but that's only for God to decide. It's very dangerous when we start this. It's my opinion. Listen, it's late. Everybody can leave now. But when we start telling other people what their motive is and they're wrong, I think that's very dangerous in our time. But I agree with you. Conceptually, yes, it's true. But practically, I don't know how you do it.
Yeah.
Anyways, Rav Hirsch had the moment get rid of Kol Nidre. I was just impressed that the Puritans got rid of Christmas for 23 years, but Hirsch only managed to get rid of Kol Nidre for 1 year. There was a revolt in a shul for obvious reasons. Can you imagine the rabbi coming into town? It was a new rabbi, I believe it was 1851, and he said, no, Kol Nidre, it's like superstition, and what the goyim was saying, we could not learn the vows, blah, blah, blah.
It's like trying to get rid of Hanan Smiris on Shabbos morning.
Yeah. Hanan Smiris is easier to get rid of. We stopped it in COVID, and it hasn't come back, which is good, whatever. Yeah, I've never been a big Hanan Smiris fan, but that's for other reasons. Okay, everybody, thank you very much. I actually put the registration now for the shiur on Wednesday for Cut the Baby in Half by Alex Magid. That would normally be left to the Mikates if to just put it there. And I want to wish everybody well. And thank you. Thank you for staying for the question and answer period, all the fun. That's what happens.
And remember, next week we're learning.
Of course we're learning. That goes without saying. Who had a Havamina that we wouldn't be learning? Yeah. So please, God, everybody have a wonderful week. Next year, tomorrow, Rava Dr. Lindsay Guhartz completes her 7-part series on Torah in translation. So that's tomorrow. She's going to be discussing English translations of the Bible, what to use, how to pick one. So we hope to see you. That's tomorrow at 11 a.m. And then tomorrow night, of course, Mark Shapiro, we're coming to the end of his series on Shaul Lieberman. And then picking up on Tuesday, Rachel Sharansky Danziger and then Rabbi Adler, continue with the Rav on Hanukkah, and then all the shiurim for the week. The Parsha Shiur this week is given by Leah Silver, and 8:30 Thursday night. And we hope to see you soon and all during the week. Okay? Be well, everybody. And don't forget to invite a friend. Hanukkah is a good time. That's a great present. A great present to invite the friend to come to a Torah Motion Shiur. It's free. There's no Hanukkah guilt there. Just tell them to come and free and whatever. But okay, be well, everybody. Have a wonderful day. I'm Hanukkah.
Thank you.